Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle. Welcome, Jamila.
Thank you.
How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic.
Good, good. You've got some good energy going today.
Yes.
Neither one of us are vampires today, right?
We're not vampires.
We're not vampires, and we're saying this because we're actually going to be talking today with OBGYN and author Dr. Christiane Northrup about her new book, Dodging Energy Vampires. We can tell you, we don't want to be an energy vampire in this particular case. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, we've got some interesting research that matters today. Let's dive right in. And the first one is about a blood test for pregnant women that could predict premature birth. Sounds important.
It certainly does. And premature birth, which is when a baby arrives at least 3 weeks early, affects 9% of U.S. births. It's the largest cause of infant mortality in the United States and the largest contributor to death before age five among children worldwide.
Wow. And traditionally, we try to identify some risk factors for this preterm birth, such as smoking, alcohol, other things that maybe lead this, whether this happened in a previous baby. And then we can somehow kind of predict maybe through an ultrasound and other things. But our science isn't so great. And this is the promise of a potential blood test that could not only diagnose preterm birth earlier, it could also estimate how old the baby is and when the mother's due date is. That sounds very good.
It certainly does. And in fact, this test measures the activity of genetic material called RNA coming from the fetus placenta in the mother that ends up in the bloodstream. And this is cell-free RNA. And the blood test was accurate 45% of the time at predicting gestational age in experiments involving 38 women compared with 48% for ultrasounds. But also it was used to predict preterm birth up to 2 months ahead of labor and 6 times out of 8. It was right, it looks like. And it also was right 4 out of 5 times in a separate group of women.
Yeah, so it seems to be a test that is as good as many, and maybe better than some, of how we're currently doing this. And they're using it from genetic material, and it appears to be potentially a maternal factor, not the baby's factor that they say. I love this quote that they said that this baby's was ready to come out. They're ready to pull the ripcord. Yet it's not yet ready for main time. Why isn't that? Why can't we just adopt it now?
It's a small study, and so certainly, although this is about 75 to 80% accurate in the small cohort, I think that what this promises is that maybe in mothers that don't have access to ultrasounds, that this could hopefully lead to healthier babies and healthier pregnancies.
Yeah, they talk about the team of researchers that's working on this. They actually had a blood test for Down syndrome a number of years ago, and that's actually used by millions of pregnant women a year. So this is a smart team. This research, I think, is published in Science magazine. Stay tuned. We're looking forward to the next levels. Speaking of stay tuned, our next research that matters is really about what does it take to actually produce a social change here. And what we're really talking about is how do we change things that happen? We've had, for instance, a tremendous explosion of understanding and seeing and reporting on sexual harassment in the workplace. How did the change in what people perceive as no longer okay occur?
Well, this study notes that when a minority group pushes change that's below 25% of the total group, the efforts fail. But when the committed minority reaches 25% or higher, then there's an abrupt change in that group dynamic. And very quickly, the majority of the population adopt the new norm.
I think that's actually really fascinating because it also suggests that individual actions matter. that it's, you know, you might be right below that tipping point, and the next person that comes around really pushes something quite similar and says, we need to change. And people maybe beforehand said, God, I'm hearing enough of this to change. Like the mechanism of why that works at that time, I'm not certain. But they did experiments, a number of different experiments, looking at when a group might change, whether that change might occur due to financial reasons or not financial reasons, and then some mathematic modeling to suggest that there is a tipping point. People have heard of that concept, and this is really about a social convention for adopting social changes.
That's right. And so when we want to prompt those large-scale changes, your voice matters. And I think in this day and age, this is a very important study for behavior and social change.
You know, I'm thinking right now, Jamila, about something that's happening around the United States relating to immigrants and the children, and whether one believes that that was not moral or whether one believes that it's just upholding the law. The simple fact is, once a certain percentage of Americans espoused a view that this was not okay, things seem to change. And whether that was 25% or not, certainly one has hard-pressed to believe that 5 or 10% of people feeling that way would have changed it. But there was a critical mass that then made something change.
Exactly.
Interesting. Talk about interesting is our next research that matters, which is about the gray matter volume in two different brain regions. And does that predict the selection of healthy food or choosing to eat unhealthy food? I'm blown away by this research.
Well, it certainly helped explain maybe why I have a predilection toward tastier choices. In this study, they looked at gray matter in two brain regions, and this predicted selection of healthy food or tasty food. And so what they found basically is our indulgence in delicious foods may not reveal a character flaw. What does it reveal, Adam?
I think it reveals, according to this research, some reasons maybe aren't fully understood, but that have a biological basis for it. And so they're finding, and they did 78 women and 45 men in four different experiments, and, you know, how these two areas of the brain, one was called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and then the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. These aren't terms that I usually kind of throw around lightly. But how things light up in these areas as you're making these choices actually can predict, perhaps long before someone develops consequence of an unhealthy choice, that a predilection for this. And so this may well be, it's not just all nurture. There may be nature here that really is influencing what we understand, in this case, potentially about obesity, which I think we just need a whole lot more science to help us understand how best to combat this. This is one small piece of the puzzle that's evolving.
That's right. And so our ability to exercise self-control is really linked to our neurobiology. In fact, I even see this in addiction models as well, where our ability to exercise self-control with respect to addictive substances is also linked to these same areas of the brain. I think this is exciting because this can give us some answers possibly to treatment of eating disorders such as anorexia or binge eating, maybe even characterize people who might be at risk for eating disorders. But remember that the brain is neuroplastic and can change. So this gray matter in the brain, much like a muscle, can be developed with exercise. There are exercises such as neurofeedback that hopefully we can get some data that shows we can strengthen those areas of the brain and exercise better self-control.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. And we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to have a conversation with Dr. Christiane Northrup about her new book, Dodging Energy Vampires. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research.
To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Today on Conversations, Jamila, we're talking with OBGYN and really acclaimed author, Dr. Christiane Northrup, about a brand new book she's written called Dodging Energy Vampires, an empath's guide to evading relationships that drain you and restoring your health and power. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Northrup.
What a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you, and you have the distinction of having a really interesting title to your book that just wants to engage you and let us jump right in. And we are going to jump into your book, but I think we want to know a little bit about you. You are such a fascinating person who's done so many interesting things. How did you get interested? Healthcare, medicine, entrepreneurism?
It's an interesting story. My brother was he wouldn't eat as an infant, and my parents had to sign him out of the hospital against medical advice, something you could not do today. I had had a sister who wouldn't eat, and she died in the hospital nursery long ago when my mother couldn't hold her. And then my brother was born, and he wouldn't eat. No one could figure it out. And a nurse came up to my mother in the middle of the night, and she said, "If I were you, I'd get him out of here. The doctors don't know what's going on." And my parents, my dad was a dentist. His brother and sister were both medical doctors. And so they figured they'd sign him out because if he were going to die, at least he'd die at home in the arms of his family versus in a pool of vomit in a neonatal intensive care unit. And so they signed him out. And I remember at the age of 1 year, he had adhesive tape putting an NG tube down. My dad kept passing an NG tube to keep him alive. And they finally found a physician at Women's Medical who was a pioneer in pediatric endoscopy. And she put a light down his esophagus and said, "His esophagus is so eroded, you got to take that tube out right now. Let's just wait and see what happens." And he started to eat for reasons that were never clear. Then when I was applying for medical school, and when I went to interview at the University of Buffalo Medical School, wouldn't you know that the physician who interviewed me had been my brother Bill's attending physician? And he said, "Are you from Ellicottville, those Northrops from Ellicottville?" "Yes." And he was sure that my brother would be dead or defective or whatever. I said, "No, he's fine." So I learned very early on that medicine didn't have all the answers, that there's more to healing than what we're taught in medical school. And so that was the beginning of it. So when I went to med school, I cried when I saw a baby born. It was like the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. And then I finally decided, okay, I love OBGYN. And then I always was open to other things that hadn't quite made it into mainstream medicine. Just was always interested about the edges.
Yeah, I know that you clearly, with training, had to use much of your medical knowledge to save lives and to diagnose diseases, but you clearly had an interest and passion for understanding what maybe isn't known.
Yes.
Yes. And so I've always thought that modern medicine had a missing piece, the body-mind-spirit connection, and that we just needed to add it. It wasn't that anything was wrong with the diagnosis and surgery and medicine and so on, but you've got to add the other stuff. You know, when you have a culture where the maternal mortality rate for black women is 3 times that of white women, even when black women are college educated, you got to look at something that is more systemic, you see.
Yep.
So that's what I've been interested in, the things that aren't necessarily on the problem list. You know, back in the 80s, I became very interested in adult children of alcoholics. And then further, the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study that started at Kaiser San Diego, and pointing out that the number of adverse childhood experiences that someone had was directly related to the number of emergency room visits and the premature death rate. So that was the, you know, kind of unspoken things that we're really not, as a nation and as physicians, prepared to deal with, because how are you going to bring that up in a 10-minute visit?
In fact, actually, the social determinants of health is a big piece of my interest, and I bring it up in the population that I'm serving with the ACE tool. And you're right, there are certainly differences in outcomes when there is an ACE score of 4 or more, an ACE score of 6 or more with respect to chronic inflammation and toxic stress.
Yes.
And so we certainly do have a lot more to do, but I'm certainly thankful for my experiences and training, and it has allowed me, and so to speak, to expand on that biopsychosocial model so that I am treating the whole body, mind, spirit. And with that holistic approach, let's dive right into your book. I know I saw this book and I thought, oh my goodness, I'm an empath. And it resonated with me because you gave me a name to call some of these toxic relationships that were literally zapping me. And, you know, I wanted to kind of know for our listeners, you know, what's an empath? What is an energy vampire?
Right. Okay. So an empath is a person who is sensitive and feels the feelings of other people. So one of my empathic healer friends, she says, here's how it was for me as a child. Please feel better so I don't have to be miserable. Literally, an empath makes an amazing healer because we feel other people's energy. And then there's a whole group of empaths, women particularly with what are called super traits of loyalty, compassion, can-do attitude, optimism. And we're the group that miss the red flag. We don't miss the red flags of an energy vampire, but we think that our compassion and our love will be able to heal these characters. So this is where the energy vampire comes in. In psychiatry, we have a subgroup of patients called Cluster B. And Cluster B refers to a personality disorder where someone just doesn't have a moral compass. Now, it's a spectrum, so it's like autism. So some people just have self-centered narcissistic traits, and you can live with that. And then some, way out on the spectrum, are psychopaths. When we hear psychopath, we think psychopathic killer. Most psychopaths are not in the criminal justice system, but they are people with a great deal of superiority. They think that the rules don't apply to them. The true psychopaths have no moral compass, and they are, I mean, the current version of those would be Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein, where they are often charismatic, larger than life, or the men at Enron. There's a wonderful documentary called The Smartest Guys in the Room, where the Enron executives literally had all their employees buy Enron stock when they knew full well that the stock was going down. They all divested. Many of them made millions, while the guys who had been linemen in Oregon lost their entire life savings.
Oi.
Yeah.
We're going to need to actually take a short break.
Let's do it.
Okay. We're going to take a little pause. I think you've touched some nerves, and not in a bad way, in a good way. You got our nervous systems revved up here, and we're just like, we're wanting to go. You know, I don't like the Enron. I don't like the Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein. Don't like any of that. I got to figure out how to dodge it all and move in.
We'll
take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue our conversation talking with Dr. Christiane Northrup about her new book, Dodging Energy Vampires. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golston and Dr. Jamila Batto. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with OBGYN and author Dr. Northrup about her new book, Dodging Energy Vampires, An Empath's Guide to Evading Relationships That Drain You and Restoring Your Health and Power. Speaking of restoring your health and power, what does this relationship between the empath and the energy vampire look like? I suspect there's some shift of power, maybe some control imbalance. Tell us a little bit about that.
What happens is, let's just do a, you know, kind of a standard thing where a woman is married to a narcissistic man. And he, at first, he says to her, "Oh, thank God I found you." Or, "I know you've had patients like this. Thank God I found you because no one else could heal me." And then this little part of you goes, "Oh, God, I really want to help. So thank God I can help this person." What happens then is you begin to give your attention and your energy to this person, but they don't take your advice. They don't do anything to change. They just say yes, they take your energy, nothing happens, they only call you when they're in trouble or they want your energy, and you become drained, they become filled up. In any standard family practice, it's estimated that 25 to 30% of the patient load is personality disorder. Help me, you can't. Now, have you had people like that in your practice?
Not only my practice, but family members. And I would suspect listeners would want to know how to recognize these energy vampires and what should they do even when it's a patient or a friend or a family member even.
Yeah, because it often is. So the term is boundaries. You have to have boundaries. You need to learn how to say no. So you've got to practice. Because most of us empaths, we want to be a part of the solution. So we say, "Yes, can you help me move on Saturday?" And you go, "Yes." So what we want to do instead is we want to say, "I'll get back to you." We need to learn to put the oxygen mask on ourselves first before assisting others. And most of us are willing to overgive until we're drained. So what you want to do is you got to reconnect with your gut knowing. When this person walks in the room, how do you feel? And then you want to put up a boundary and say, "I simply can't." You got to have some phrases, "I simply can't." And the first thing that's going to happen, you'll feel bad that you couldn't meet the need. Do you feel that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you're talking about how to dodge that in the title. These people who you don't feel better when you're finished interacting with them. And we have people like that in our lives. And I guess as a physician, though, it seems like sometimes my job is to help fix that. How do you deal with this kind of therapeutic need as a provider? You're a well-established, very well-known author, but also physician. So fixing it versus avoiding it.
Okay. What we found, you perhaps know the work of Marsha Linehan, who wrote Dialectic Behavioral Therapy mm-hmm. for Borderline Personality Disorder. And Marsha Linehan herself had been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. These are often the people, usually women, not always, who come to the emergency room 260 times a year. So they're called frequent flyers. And if you see them on the psych ward, a diagnostic sign is that they have a teddy bear with them. So these people are kind of stuck, and they drain the energy of everyone around them. So the DBT groups that are around the country now are the way to go with them, or cognitive behavioral therapy, giving them what they want, giving them your life energy. Like when they come into the office and they don't have an appointment, or when they begin splitting. Splitting is what they do. Let's you and her fight. Like if someone is married to one of these people, they will probably try to enlist you in some drama. This is all called narcissistic supply. It's talk about me good, talk about me bad, just talk about me. So they kind of live off the life energy of others. And the most loving thing you can do is cut off that supply so that they learn, which most of them don't, and I'm sorry about that, but so that they learn to source their life from the same place you do, which is God, your inner being, your own inner resources. But they use others, and they very often don't change. But the only way they will change is if you finally withdraw your attention and set up boundaries. And you can do it in a loving way.
What are some of the loving, compassionate ways, meaning maybe the language that we can use so that we can shore up our defenses?
Well, first of all, you say, this works very well. When they come at you because they need your energy, you can actually say, I am not feeling so well. Because when they see that you have a need, they're going to scram. They're going to go get the need met somewhere else. So you have to, the first thing you need to do is put the attention back on you and get it off of them, because they're a bottomless pit. They're an abyss, and they will take as much as you have to give them. So put the focus back on yourself. Learn to say, no, I simply can't. Eventually, what you'll find is you'll change your entire environment so you won't have these people in your life anymore. And if you do, then let's say it's a family member. You can do a nice boundaried interaction. So, for instance, a friend of mine has a narcissistic father. They both like theater and they like movies. So her visits with him consist of lunch and a movie. It's got a beginning and it has an end. And she finds that every time she has thought it'll be different this time, I can spend the night at his house, she's always drained. So she's learned this works. But more than this does not work. So it's healthy boundaries and taking care of yourself.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me, Dr. Northrup, of some of the work with Al-Anon, with family members or friends or acquaintances or patients who have alcohol problems or substance abuse problems. And you learn quickly about the 12 steps and you learn about how you can't control other people. You can't control. You have to release control, and you have to be able to say, I have a life too. And I find that something that's really difficult, but that boundary setting seems to be the start. But compassionate boundary setting and compassionate transparency, it seems to be really important, at least for me as a provider.
Yes, because you have to do something consistent with your own values. And I learned this from Dr. George Simon, who wrote In Sheep's Clothing. And Dr. Simon has worked with these individuals enough over the years. Like for 25 years, he's taught therapists about these individuals and why they don't change. But in his own dealings with them, he's extraordinarily compassionate and non-judgmental while still setting a boundary. So an example would be, let's say that we have a guy who's beating his wife and they come in for therapy. And the guy starts with, well, she made me do it. And then he looks at the guy and says, no, really? Did she go into the motor cortex of your brain and lift your arm to hit her? And then the person goes, no. You know, so when you call them on the behavior, but from a place of compassion, they'll often admit it, because what he pointed out to me is they know what they're doing, and they keep doing it because it works. And here's the thing for all of us. We have been taught that only hurt people hurt people. So we make excuses. Oh, they had a difficult childhood, or, oh, this happened to them. That's why they're like they are. This is simply wrong, and it's very hard for those of us in the healing professions to believe this, because we are healers and we want to help, but we have to get over the notion that it is childhood pain that makes them act the way they do, because most people who've had childhood pain do not act like this.
Speaking of childhood pain, I certainly can relate to that, and I'm certainly an empath, and I appreciate all this conversation, as do many of our listeners. Before we wrap up, would you like to leave us any final thoughts?
Yes, final thoughts are this. 1 in 5 people fits the Cluster B diagnostic category. That's 20% of people on the planet. And the most loving thing you can possibly do is put the attention back on yourself as an empath, because you carry a tremendous amount of light and love, and you are here to be part of the solution. You are not here to be an energy source, a drain toward an energy vampire who has to learn the lesson of being a compassionate human being. And they're not quite there yet, so don't enable them.
Yeah, I think if you don't care for yourself, who will care for you? So I appreciate the sentiments. We appreciate Dr. Christiane Northrup for being our guest today on Your Health and sharing your love of people and being able to look inside to be able to take care of yourself better.
Thank you so much.
We're going to put up the book, Dodging Energy Vampires, on our website and a link to it for our listeners. We're going to take a short break. And when we coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamelia Battle. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Jamelia and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And Jamelia, if a listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today.
I recently heard someone say that medical professionals don't like Neosporin anymore. Is that true? And if so, why?
Well, I don't think we can make comments about all of medicine, all of healthcare professionals here. I think that there's this triple antibiotic cream and these combination products that sometimes some providers who have a lot more experience would say, maybe it's not the best one. I know one of the ingredients can be allergy causing. People can develop an allergy to the antibiotic. We also know that the more antibiotics one takes, the more one may be killing good bacteria as well as bad bacteria. So I think in general, providers are becoming a little more educated about this. What do you think?
I think that sounds correct. And, you know, there are also some alternative measures that can be tried as well to maintain healthy flora and bacteria.
Like what? What do you like?
So I like hydrogen peroxide.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times you can just dilute that down and it's an antiseptic.
Mm-hmm.
I use soap and water. I mean, you know, soap and water is like an old standby.
About that one.
There's not a whole lot of resistance out there to soap. You don't hear about that. Like, here's a new type of thing to counter the soap effect.
Right.
You know,
the
bacteria seem to get resistant to soap.
That's true.
One of my favorite ones. But I think the one chemical is called neomycin, and that's the one that can be really sensitizing in some of these things. So you could just use a polysporin that just has a single ingredient here, or bacitracin, that one ingredient if you needed it.
Exactly.
Sometimes just a Band-Aid works.
And sometimes it does.
Just a little Band-Aid, a little soap and water, kind of works well. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've been experiencing significant joint pain recently when I wake up in the morning. I'm a 45-year-old woman, and this is new for me. Should I be concerned about it?
Well, you've never had it before. That always raises a little bit of a red flag to me. I mean, if you're like me and you've been waking up every day for about 10 years with a little bit of joint pain, it wouldn't be so surprising. But, Jamil, what's it make you just kind of start to think about different things?
I think for me, it makes me think about maybe rheumatoid arthritis or some kind of autoimmune arthritis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those things would like not come on typically all of a sudden, but then if you kind of get it, you have to start thinking about them, right?
That's
like,
right.
Like, what's changed here? And so I think we would think a lot about those things. I sometimes, you know, common things happen commonly. Viruses. There are some viruses. What's one of those viruses we used to read about there? Parvovirus. But almost any virus can cause some joint pain.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Maybe gout.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Or kind of common things, again, commonly, arthritis of the spine, osteoarthritis. You know, it just seems like it's got to start hurting one day.
Right.
Oh, dear. You know, it's like, oh, my goodness, I don't remember hurting before, and now it's hurting. Oh, yeah, I went out and ran about 6 miles yesterday, and I'm not a big runner. Yeah, it's hurting today.
Right.
I don't know. Laura, on your end, any sort of things that you oftentimes wonder or worry about when you get aches and pains?
I'm very sensitive to medications. I've had one instance where a medication gave me some joint pain. Actually, maybe a couple times that's happened. So I generally immediately get on the portal and send my doctor a quick email.
Ooh, I like that
one.
Yeah, medications. We oftentimes don't think about those.
Yep.
Either prescription medications or even non-prescription medications could sometimes cause inflammation and pain. Yeah.
Yep, that's a great point.
What's our very next house call?
I'm currently taking Suboxone after developing a dependence on a painkiller. How long should I stay on it, and can I just take it as needed?
So Suboxone is meant to be taken chronically, much like if you were a diabetic and needed insulin. This is how we should treat the Suboxone. And studies have shown that really you need to stay on this medication for at least a year to heal the brain, because opiate dependence over time can really cause a brain injury. And so what you want to do is take this medication as prescribed to give it a chance to reach steady state, to prevent withdrawals, craving, but also giving it time to heal the neural anatomy in the brain and really to, for lack of the scientific word, calm down the animal brain and create neural pathways that will bring the executive functioning back online.
Yeah, I think those are such wise words. A lot of times when I hear about some of these opioid or other chronic substance use, we talk about brain diseases, that they change the neuroanatomy of the brain, and we need time for the brain to change back. And, you know, we see this, I see it in my work in nicotine addiction all the time, that people take a medicine, it works really well, and after about 6 weeks, they go, I'm cured. Doesn't work that way, does it?
It does not.
Not in most people. And then they do well for a short period of time, and then all of a sudden that first urge comes, that first impulse comes, and then all of a sudden the defenses and the brain connections just kind of start firing again. Oh, yep, that's how I feel good again.
Exactly.
And they go back into that substance use, treacherous territory. And we say 3 months, 6 months. In this case, you're saying a year.
A year, absolutely. And if age of first use was below 26, where you developed a dependency to opiates, then sometimes lifelong.
Thank you for a great question. Laura, what's our very last house call?
My wife was recently in the hospital with a fracture and a blood clot. The team taking care of her was great, but they didn't know her. I was so pleased when my family doctor showed up, as he said, to pay a courtesy call. It was far more than a courtesy, as he noticed that she was not getting physical therapy and was still spending most of her time in the bed. I didn't know family doctors still visited patients in the hospital.
Well, isn't that pretty special? You know, we got hospitalists and we got hospitalists and even more hospitalists, but there's still a lot of family docs out there, and they get trained to do house calls.
That's right. And they will still often visit in the hospital. They will do their clinic and then go back to the hospital. There are even some that deliver babies.
Yeah, so some of them may be the doctor that's caring for you in the hospital, but in some cases, if there is a hospitalist, that doctor and that doctor, your family doc, may not be doing hospital care anymore. They still may really do care enough. And that's what I think the critical aspect mm-hmm. here is. And they do know you better than a hospitalist who's never cared for you before.
That's correct.
The question is, can it be better care than either one alone? Could be. In this particular case, right?
It does. I think it matters. And certainly my mom was in the hospital, and when her family doctor paid a visit, she was able to shed some other background information that was going on to the hospitalist team that made a difference in her care.
Wow, that's great. I would say, as for our listeners, if you have a loved one that is going in the hospital and they do have a family doc, let your family doctor know, though, that your loved one's in the hospital. It's really hard sometimes to have expectations to go visit the patient if you don't know the patient's in the hospital. Don't just assume the family doctor kind of got that email from someone or, the correction. So this could be a team effort. Win, win, win.
That's absolutely correct.
Well, that'll conclude Your Health Today. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to our listeners. Please share any questions or stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank guest co-host today, Dr. Jamila Battle, and our guest today, Dr. Christiane Northrop. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.